Blog Talk Radio.
You may not be paid for the job.
Can someone
been humble.
Well, good evening to you, Kel, and how the devil are you tonight?
I am infidelity fine.
And I'm unbelievably good as well, so that makes two of us.
There you go. We have quite a show for us today. We have a few topics we're going to move through, but one thing that we're not going to delay in doing is bringing on our guest, and that is Bonnie of Bare Naked Islam. Now, just to give you a very brief background of Bare Naked Islam, I think it needs very little explanation in that Bonnie, pre-9/11, was apolitical. But after 9/11, she saw something that she had to address, as all of us in the counter-jihadist movement have to do. And she started the blog Bare Naked Islam. This is probably one of the most prolific blog sites in the cybersphere today. And with that, I am so pleased to bring Bonnie on. But before I do that, I'm going to explain something. Bonnie and Tim are primarily going to have a conversation. I am going to sit back and listen, but I'm going to bring Bonnie on and at least say hello to her before I do that. And Bonnie, hello. How are you today?
Hi, Cal. Hi, Tim. How are you? So nice to be here.
Hello, Bonnie. Good to see you.
Hey, good to finally hear your voice.
Yes, it's good to speak to you. I've heard you on a couple of occasions when you've been on other Blog Talk radio shows. I think you were on Red Fox not too long ago, and
yes,
I remember listening in and hearing you and thinking, wouldn't it be nice to actually get to speak to you? And here we are. So that's great. I'm really, really pleased to be able to speak with you tonight.
Oh, me too. I love your leader there, Paul Weston. He and I have a great, you know, email relationship, and you know, he's doing great things. I wish he'd run for prime minister.
Well, yeah. Well, he. Oh, well. So do I. I mean, if there was going to be any sanity restored to the political landscape, then I think we could do a lot worse than somebody like Paul for prime minister, because Paul, in conjunction with Liberty GB, in my view, is streets ahead in terms of principle compared to any of the politicians who we've currently got in our political elites at the moment. So yeah, it would be really great to have somebody like Paul Weston as prime minister. And,
well, you know, there's hope. There's hope. I mean, look who Australia just elected, Tony Abbott, and look what he's doing with reducing the asylum seeker in Vegas.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, Norway just elected a conservative who is cracking down on illegal immigrants. So there's hope. I mean, a lot of these solid leftist states have gone to the right. So I think it's going to take more time, I think, for the UK, but you know, maybe in 6 or 8 years, you will have a decent.
Well,
government.
I think you might be surprised. You know, there's a saying that we have over here, which is a week is a long time in politics. I mean, for all
yes.
I know, that might be a universal saying. Okay, but I'm actually quite heartened by what I've seen, and I've only been on Blog Talk Radio speaking as a guest or a panelist or a co-host for about 6 months, and even in that 6 months, I've seen a lot of changes in people's attitudes towards what's going on. 6 months ago, I encountered quite a lot of doom and gloom with the people that I spoke to, and they said, oh, it's so terrible, everything that's happening, and what can we do about it? You know, everything's against us. And I said, well, it's actually not as bad as all that. And the reason I gave for it not being as bad as all that, and I think the reason is as true today as it was 6 months ago, is the fact that we do have something that our forefathers and our ancestors never had when they were up against the possibilities of making massive political change. I mean, in the past, obviously, there have been times and places you can look at in history where there have been massive political change. I mean, I'm okay couple of examples out of the air. The French Revolution is one of them, where I dare say the people who were in power thought that they were going to maintain the regime for hundreds of years. And then all of a sudden, in the space of a very short period of time, all right, there was a lot of blood on the streets, okay, but there was change. Now, we've got the, but they never had anything like the internet to inform people and to change public opinion in an informed way. But we have the internet today, and with the with people who are running the various blogs and the websites and social media, Facebook, Twitter, and, of course, dare I say it, Blog Talk Radio, we have tremendous power in influencing people that just wasn't available even only a few short years ago. You know, 10, 15 years ago, who had heard of Blog Talk Radio? Go back 2 years, who had heard of Twitter or Facebook? And these forms of medium are extremely influential, to the extent that I am pretty confident when I say they are overtaking the traditional mainstream media in terms of the number of people that they can influence in a very short period of time. And when you get a sufficient number of people waking up, I think you are going to see change a lot quicker than you might otherwise have thought. But yeah, it's good to see we've got people in Norway and Australia who have every prospect of making a difference.
Right, and look at France, what's happening with Front National. You know, they've been leading in some of the polls, which is shocking, but it's a very good sign, I think.
Oh, yes, and of course, and in Holland, you've got Geert Wilders and his anti-Islam party there that are making great strides. And I
he and I are on the illustrious list of Islamophobes of 2014. Some group in England put out a list, and for some reason...
Oh, I saw that.
In the U.S., they have Barack Obama on it, which I cannot understand.
Well, no,
but no.
No,
I'm very happy to, you know, share the illustrious Islamophobe.
Well, that's absolutely tremendous. I mean, I do remember that, I don't know if they're doing it this year, but Jihad Watch and Atlas Shrugs Between Them used to host a similar sort of show every year. They had, well, not so much Islamophobes. I think they had Dimmies of the Year.
Right.
And they used to nominate politicians and so on, or mainstream media reporters who had shown exceptional signs of dimitude. But yeah, Islamophobes of the Year, if you can get on that list, well, you've cracked it.
I hope I win. I don't know what I'll win.
I'll be rooting for you. I mean,
A trip to Spongistan.
Oh, Spongistan.
A trip to where?
Yeah. Now, you may not know about Spongistan, Bonnie, but on Friday evenings we have an illustrious caller who frequently calls into the EDL radio show. His name is Parbi, and he comes from Spongistan.
Uh-huh.
And it's a great place. It's called Spongistan. Its national slogan is "We sponge off you and you stunt for it," which I think is a tremendous play on words.
Oh,
I think the national bird is a yak, I think. Isn't that right, Kel? I think it's a yak.
Yak.
Yeah,
they have yak sled races. Yeah,
they have yak sled races. I mean, it sounds like a tremendous place to go for a holiday. And
oh,
they've also got a new political slogan, which has been taken up by people around the world. One man, one yak, one sled, one vote. And I think Kel's actually put that on her timeline on Facebook. It's a tremendous slogan, and I think we could all do well to adopt it.
Oh, I'm sure. Listen, Tim, I really want to know what's going on with your case, with your whatever they call it, defamation.
Well, it's a bit more than defamation, Bonnie. I'll go back to June 2013, which is when all this kicked off.
Right.
As you probably know, the chap in question, a chap called Fiaz Mughal, who runs the Tell Mama UK online hate detection site, his organisation searches for online hate on the internet and makes a puts gets as much in the way of online hate crime as it can find, creates a database, and then informs the necessary authorities so that the culprits can be appropriately arrested or disciplined or whatever. The idea, of course, is that it promotes the advancement of Islam simply through the chilling of free speech, which is, I mean, one of the reasons why I was I had my suspicions about Shiaz Magal and his motives when I first heard of him, which would have been about a year ago, I suppose.
But
anyway,
Tim, didn't the government cut his funding because all the made-up stuff they were posting as hate crimes?
Well, yeah, that's right. This is where it gets interesting. Last year, the Daily Telegraph, which is one of our newspapers, ran an expose on his organisation, alleging just that he had taken his hate crime figures, and apparently there wasn't enough hate crime to go round, and he had resorted to falsifying the statistics of his organisation in a fraudulent way in order to continue getting money from the taxpayer. And anyway, he'd been rumbled. This was what had happened. The Association of Chief Police Officers called him into a meeting together with the Department of Communities and Local Government, and they said, basically, your figures don't add up. And anyway, there was a bit of a robust exchange of words, shall we say, and Fiaz Magal threw all his toys out of the pram, stormed out of the meeting, and subsequently had his money withdrawn by the holder of the government purse strings. And I was asked about this. You know, the holder of the government purse strings is actually an ancient and honourable order, and this wizened old gentleman wanders around the corridors of power with this purse full of gold coins, and he jangles it in front of people's faces and then snatches it away when he withdraws their funding. It's a tremendous thing to see. You know, they televise it every now and again. It's absolutely fantastic. But anyway, leaving that aside, Fiaz Magal had his funding withdrawn, as you so rightly say, because he had been fraudulently misrepresenting the statistics. Anyway, when I
heard you're telling the truth about him.
Indeed, that
it's
was
a
the
crime
whole. That's the
now?
Whole.
I can't understand
well, yeah.
it.
Well,
can't understand it.
The when I heard about it, I tweeted a few choice tweets on my Twitter timeline to the effect that I disapproved. Basically,
yes.
I was outraged. I was incensed, and I called him, amongst other things, a mendacious, grievance mongering taquilla artist. I also, to my eternal shame, I also called him a lying Muslim scumbag. And I think that might have tipped him over
also
the edge.
Also true.
Well, yes, I mean, the thing is, the word scumbag was perhaps somewhat intemperate, and you could argue that it was unworthy of the recipient of a good old British 1950s education. I maybe could and should have used a word that was a little bit more colourful and a little bit more descriptive. But you know what they say, 2020 hindsight is a wonderful thing. So anyway, I posted these tweets on the internet, and Fiaz Magal didn't like it at all. He trotted round to his local police station, and he wanted them to charge me with something, and he was obviously very, very offended. But you can't go around arresting people just for being offensive.
Right.
You have to make something up. So he told the police that I had been harassing him on Twitter, and that he felt threatened, alarmed, and distressed by my remarks. Now, if you've ever seen that great big lump of lard, Fiaz Magal, you'll find it rather difficult to see how he could feel threatened, distressed, or alarmed by anything at all, unless, of course, it's a treadmill at his local gym, in which case it probably would be. But he made this complaint, and the police officers jumped to attention, because, after all, this chap is not just, he's not just the director of this one organisation, he's the director of several similar organisations, But this is the main one that comes into the public domain most often. But he's a member of the Order of the British Empire, which means that at some point in the not too distant past, our dear Queen has seen fit to call him in to her front room and stick a medal on his chest for something something that he allegedly did, which was presumably good for the community, because that's what you get an OBE for if you've done something notable. So anyway, he obviously thinks he's a very important person, not to be talked down to by the likes of Cat Strangler 101, that's me, on my Twitter timeline, and he registered this complaint. So anyway, the police jumped to it. They said, right, sir, right, we'll get right on it, don't you worry. And they do speak like that, you know. It's straight out the 1950s Ealing Studios movie, but they do still speak like that when they go out and search for people who've been doing bad things. You know, you've seen it all. Hello, hello, hello. What's all this then?
Tell me, Tim, were these policemen part of the Muslim Police Association, or were they regular British police?
No, they are regular British police officers.
Police.
Well, the thing is, it becomes slightly murky at this point because it transpires, I have since found, that West Midlands Police have actually been partnering with Tell Mama UK in order to bring the appropriate diversity, multicultural and politically correct attitude to the West Midland Police Force, which is something I didn't know at the time, and I've only recently found out. But, yeah, there's actually this partnership that exists. Mm-hmm. So when Tell Mama, when Fiaz Magal snaps his fingers, the police naturally jump to attention, and they go hurtling round at high speed with, you know, the helicopters and the SWAT teams and the dog handlers. All right, I'm exaggerating a bit. But they come round, tyres screeching to a halt outside my house, you know, and they invite me into the police station for questioning. They very kindly volunteer to look after my computer and my smartphone in case there's anything incriminating on it. they charge me with racially aggravated harassment. Now, this is quite different, Bonnie, from a civil defamation suit. Quite different. It's actually a criminal charge. And if, when my case comes to court, I am found guilty of harassing, threatening, causing distress or alarm or anything like this, I could actually end up behind bars. This is not a slap on the wrist we're talking about.
It's outrageous. I don't know how anyone in their right mind could consider what you said a threat. You didn't threaten to do anything to him.
this is going to be one of the obvious things I'll be pointing out on the day. There's a couple of aspects to the case, but one of them is, as you say, how could such a thing be calculated as a threat? I contend that it couldn't possibly be calculated, be seen by any reasonable person as a threat in any way, shape or form. Now, all I have to do is to convince the presiding magistrates, or if it eventually gets to a Crown Court level, convince the presiding judge of the validity of that argument. But the problem is, of course, that in this politically correct, multicultural, ethnically diverse environment that we find ourselves in, you can't predict exactly which way the magistrates or the presiding judge is going to jump. It is a potential minefield. And if you look at some of the cases that have been brought over the past couple of years to courts, we've had people arrested for having a racist ringtone on their mobile phone. I kid you not.
I would be in jail for life if I lived in England, right?
that point. There are things that when I was growing up, sort of 40 or 50 years ago, we took a much more common sense approach to things like this. And if somebody said something offensive or that somebody didn't like, well, it didn't usually result in anything to do with the police at all. Or if the police did get involved, be a question of getting the two parties together and giving one or other a stern talking to and making them apologize and shake hands, and that would be the end of it, you know. But mm-hmm. common sense has gone out of the window. And yeah. another case that I can think of along the same lines was somebody who was arrested recently for revving his car engine in a racist manner. Now, how do you do that? How is that possible? You might well ask. But apparently he was driving behind some Muslim couple, and I don't know if they were walking too slowly or he just wanted them to get away, but he revved his car engine. And looked at one another and they thought, yeah, here's grounds for an arrest for racial harassment. And they had him arrested for revving his car in a racist manner, and he spent time behind bars for that.
Oh, yeah.
So,
did it?
Well, I mean, the exact details of that case, I would have to dig up and find for you. But I'm sure I could find it. This is the point that this is not anecdotal evidence. These are actual cases that have come to pass in the past couple of years, and people who are rightly concerned about the loss of our freedoms in this country. And of course, it isn't just this country; it's everywhere. But it's getting particularly bad in the UK. People are making notes of these kind of decisions, and they're logging them for future reference, so that when political sanity is eventually restored, we start looking for the people who've been involved in these ridiculous decisions, and we can take them to task. And that's
Are your judges elected or appointed?
When it comes to the judiciary, I think it's mostly that they're appointed. Certainly that's the case with High Court judges. I believe it's the case with Crown Court judges. And I believe it's also the case with magistrates. Now, if somebody... Kel's just made a note to say that in the chat room to say they are appointed. Magistrates, you normally have three magistrates on a bench, one senior magistrate and two juniors, and then they come to a joint decision together. But if you go to Crown Court, you get a judge and what they call 12 good men and true. Of course, you just have to hope they are 12 good men and true and not 12 husbands if you ever get...
Right. So the party in power appoints them?
That's a good question, actually. I don't think it's so much of a political process as it is in the USA. I may have to come back to you on the details of that, because I'm not sure of the exact process by which they come to power. But generally, certainly with magistrates that I'll be appearing in front of next week, unless things change, I believe just have to be a member of good standing in the community, and I think you can apply to go through a certain amount of training, and then if you're thought to be a suitable person, then I think other people in the judiciary can nominate you, and then you get seconded, and then you get appointed. I think that's how it works.
I mean, if they're any kind of decent human beings, they'll just drop this case, because it just seems like it's a nuisance case.
You would think so, wouldn't you? As I say, if it wasn't for the fact that we've had so many other cases that have been brought to court and that have resulted in people going to prison for very, very minor things like having a racist ringtone, like revving your car in a racist manner, I would agree with you. But the trouble is that because of this politically correct multicultural environment that we've had here over the last 30 or 40 years, people who've gone through the education system in the last 30 or 40 years have become used to thinking that the politically correct multicultural mindset is a normal thing and to be, to be followed. But really, we have at some point, we have to break this. I have
one piece of good news for you out of England today. You may not have seen it. A Muslim convert, was jailed for 3 years for threatening an infidel. But of course, the infidel is a member of the royal family, Prince Harry. This is the first time I've seen a Muslim jailed for threatening anything.
Yes, well, I suppose it's obviously going to be a high-profile thing if it's threatening our very own Prince Harry.
Right.
I'm just looking. I'm actually looking at your site as we're talking about this, and
yeah,
I can see. I can see the article. I see it says at the bottom, Roxanne Morell, mitigating, said her client had a personality disorder. Yes,
yeah.
Don't they all, as you say? Well, you know, if you're Muslim, it goes with the territory, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, so I suppose it's a good thing that we are getting some results of that nature. But, of course, all too often, what we're finding is that Muslims are committing various criminal and antisocial activities. And a lot of the time, they get away with them purely because
right.
they're Muslim. And even if their activities are brought to the attention of the police or the appropriate authorities, they are reluctant to act for fear of being seen as racist or Islamophobic. Now, that's
right.
certainly...
What did you think of, I'm sorry,
recently,
the Paul Golding from Britain First? He was arrested and not allowed to come to London anymore or participate in any political activities. But the court did throw that out, so...
Well, let me see. Paul Golding... I don't know a great deal about Paul Golding and Britain First in particular, but I believe that the reason that he was arrested was he actually went round to the house of one of the... Was it Anne Jem Chowdhury's house?
Yes.
Well, good for him is what I say. But the thing is, then that constitutes real harassment. You know, if you go around to somebody's house and make a nuisance of yourself outside their house... unfortunately, the way the laws are constructed, that is actually harassment. And
mm-hmm.
I suppose the police at that point felt they've got no alternative but to do something.
Right.
But I mean, this is the interesting thing, actually, Bonnie. When you go round to somebody's house, or if you accost them in the street, or if you accost them at their workplace,
mm-hmm.
the reason it's harassment is they can't easily get out of that without... without some kind of downside. Let's say, for example, they feel threatened and they turn tail and run. Okay, well, that's going to involve a certain loss of face. Let's just say, for example, you wag your finger under somebody's nose and they decide to get into a shouting match with you. Well, that could involve a certain loss of dignity, for example.
Oh.
If you're particularly obnoxious when you're wagging your finger under their nose, they could... you know, thump you between the eyes, but then they open themselves up to a charge of common assault. So there's a downside there.
Yeah, but
so
they were nowhere near him. I mean, they were kind of across the street, and when he saw them, he got into his car and drove away. So, you know, there was no physical contact. But he was given draconian punishment at first, not being able to go into London or participate in any political activities at all. I mean,
thankfully,
you had a judge with common sense who threw it out.
That does sound like a little over the top, and I think if that was all he was doing, and he got threatened with, you know, not being able to go into London, I mean, that might affect your ability to carry on your work, for example.
No, that
was
all he was doing because I saw they had it on video. I saw the whole thing. You know, they
were
across the street and just saying, you know, come out and talk to us or whatever. But he came out and he just drove away. They weren't within 100 feet of him, I don't think.
Well, in that case, that does sound a little bit over the top. But, I mean, the point is, even if you classify that as harassment,
mm-hmm.
I contend that it's a million miles away from a situation on social media. If you send somebody a tweet on social media, all they have to do is a couple of mouse clicks and you can block the person that's tweeting you. I mean, the people who designed the Twitter platform were very perspicacious, and they foresaw a time when some of their users might decide to be mean to some of their other users, so they incorporated the block button. So I contend that it's actually impossible to harass anybody on Twitter at all, because a couple of mouse clicks and you get rid of the person without any loss of face, any loss of dignity, any chance of a criminal charge of assault, or any psychological anxiety from having to put up with the tweets that the person sends. Two mouse clicks and they're gone.
Yeah. What does your lawyer have to say about it? Does he think, you know, there's a chance he'll throw it out?
Well, he says that when it comes to case law in involving social media such as Facebook and Twitter and so on, that there isn't a great deal of it, and that it's breaking ground is the phrase that he used. And so it depends very much on how you can present your case when it comes to court. Now, one of the things I want to do, because this case involves the use of the word taqiyya, okay, in mendacious grievance mongering taqiyya artist, okay, I think it's appropriate to explain exactly what taqiyya is to the presiding court. Now, that is a very interesting concept, because if you could get the magistrates or a judge in a court to accept the true meaning of the word taqiyya being the opportunity or the obligation in some cases for Muslims to lie if it furthers the cause of Islam, that then could set a precedent for the whole relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims. Because if you are, for example, permitted by the Quran to lie under oath, all right, then it's quite different from what we do in our Judeo-Christian society when we swear on the Bible in court that we are going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. What we are doing is affirming in front of God that we are going to tell the truth. And if we don't, God-fearing Christians, we should be subject to, I don't know, some kind of, if maybe I say eternal punishment, but I mean the point is
perjury.
We should feel feel guilty about telling a lie. That's the whole concept of how truthfulness and untruthfulness works in our civilization. But of course in Islam it's completely different. Muslims are allowed to tell a lie if it furthers the cause of Islam, or if it prevents Islam from being denigrated, when such furthering of the cause or the prevention of denigration cannot be achieved by telling the truth. And of course, that's pretty much any time a Muslim discusses Islam with somebody. He's not going to tell you the truth, because if you knew the truth about Islam, you wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. So Muslims have to lie about it to get it accepted at all. And of course, when you're talking about under oath, the Quran specifically allows for lying, even under oath. And that
you
is
have
something
the quotes from the Quran that say that?
I do have that, which I will try and bring up during the course of this conversation. Yeah. I do actually have something which specifically refers to that, and it's so important that
it really needs to be raised and discussed.
It really does need to be raised and discussed in public. And if we could get a legal ruling on it, then I think it would be quite something.
I have a video on it, a really good video on taqiyya. If you can use a tablet or something in the court, you could show it to the judge. I'll send it to you.
Well, that would be great. I mean, at the moment, I'm reading up as much about taqiyya as I can. But what I really want to do is to get an expert witness in, and because the prosecution will say, "Well, Mr. Burton, you're not a Muslim. You don't know anything about Islam."
Oh, right.
You know, the prosecution will try and play it down, and I will have great difficulty unless I can produce an expert witness. Well, I have got one lined up, and if I can get him in court on the day, I think it will be an entertaining day. You want to get yourself some popcorn, sit at the back of the court, and just watch the proceedings, because there will be fireworks. Now, I've actually found the surah here from the Quran. I'll read the paragraph to you. Only take me a few seconds, if that's all right. Taqiyya can be practiced even when under oath. Surah 2.225. Allah will not call you to account for thoughtlessness in your oaths, but for the intention in your hearts. And Surah 5.89, Allah will not call you to account for what is futile in your oaths, but he will call you to account for your deliberate oaths. Now, if you look at that carefully, what it is actually saying is you can lie under oath. That is the implication. Now, of course, I can say that, and the prosecution will say, well, Mr. Burton would say that, wouldn't he? In fact, it doesn't mean anything of the sort. What it means is taqiyya is the art of looking after your kittens and making sure they're well fed, or something like that. And they'll say one thing, and I'll say another. And what I need is my expert witness to confirm what I say. So, when I get my expert witness in court, as I say, there will be fireworks, because if this is accepted by the magistrates, I don't see how you could then have any kind of conviction that involved evidence from a Muslim at all. The thing is that magistrates and judges won't necessarily give a legal ruling on this. They might say, we're not going to accept evidence that casts suspicions on Islam. They are free to say that. And I don't know whether we can get a legal ruling, but I think it's got to be worth a shot.
Right.
In any case, the whole question of taqiyya is crucial, because it's one of the words that I used in my tweets, and therefore the opportunity to debate it in court and to fully discuss it, I think, is really, really welcome. So that's
what he did that got the funding cut by the government, which is also taqiyya. I mean, I think you should tie that whole thing in.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when I was thinking about what I'd actually said, and I thought, well, should I really have chosen my words differently? And I thought, well, why should I? Because he is a liar, a fraud, and a cheat. And it wasn't so much he was practicing taqiyya, because taqiyya involves an element of deception, but this guy was an out-and-out fraud. He fraudulently misrepresented the statistics of his organization in order to get money from the British taxpayer. Now, as far as I know, he hasn't yet been prosecuted for that act. Now, when I last looked, doing something like that in order to obtain money was actually a criminal offence. And I think that he should be prosecuted for it. And if I get the opportunity to make that point in court, I certainly will. There's also another aspect of his testimony, which I only discovered in the last couple of weeks, which is the way he phrased his complaint in the police statement, that actually calls into question his truthfulness as well. Although I'm not going to go into that live on the air. I'm going to keep that as a little surprise up my sleeve for when it comes to court. But let's just say, when Fiaz Magal comes to court, he is going to wish he had never messed with the cat. That's what I can say.
Good luck with that.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. Yeah, but I mean, it's gone far beyond a case of simple harassment, and it opens up lots of questions concerning the loss of our freedoms, and freedom of speech in particular, that I think need to be addressed, and it's long overdue. And
we're not that far behind you over here. I mean, our First Amendment protects us from a lot, but the Muslims, specifically CARE, I'm sure you're familiar with CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations. I mean, they're trying to make everything a hate crime. You know, if you call a woman with a headscarf a name, then it's a hate crime. Everything with them is a hate crime. And some of this stuff is sticking, not to the point where you've been charged, but I see it. I see them chipping away at our First Amendment and getting away with it. I mean, they've done it to me. CARE has gotten me removed from my web host 3 times, you know, with charges of hate speech. And they did it a couple of years ago, and then just recently they couldn't do it with my web host, but they found the web host parent company and somehow convinced them to kick me off their server. So I've had three experiences, and just, you know, calling everything I do hate speech. So people are buying into it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is an appalling thing, but yes, at the moment, they do have a lot of political clout and a lot of influence, and they can push things their way at the moment. But I think there's two things I'd like to say about that, Bonnie. One is that if they've taken the trouble to do that to you three times, that mm-hmm. what that says to me is that you are being very effective and you need to keep it up. That's the first thing.
It's getting expensive to have to keep moving.
Well, yes, okay, there is a cost, and of course, even going to court and defending yourself, like I'm having to do here, has a cost, whether or not I win or lose.
Right.
Now, people have been very, very, very good and very supportive, and mm-hmm. we have had a legal defence fund set up on the Liberty GB website, and mm-hmm. people have been very supportive, donating to that legal defence fund, which is great. But it really does rankle with me that the process is the punishment almost, in mm-hmm. that if somebody like this who is a liar, a fraud, and a cheat that Fiaz Magal is, and I don't care if you're listening, Fiaz, as far as I'm concerned, you're a liar, you're a fraud, and you're a cheat, and that is the long and the short of it. But somebody like that can go and lay a charge against somebody like me, and they can have me arrested, and they can put me through a lot of inconvenience, and just generally make life a real pain in the neck, even if I subsequently win the case, which I do expect to. I think if as you say, if the judge or the magistrates are reasonable people, then mm-hmm. I think my arguments should prevail. The problem is,
can you sue for false arrest? If you win, can you sue like the police for false arrest?
That might be. I wouldn't like to say that I would have a cast iron case, because mm-hmm. what had happened was the police obviously felt they had to respond to the complaint that Fiaz Magal made, and when they got me in the interview room, and they showed me the copy of these tweets, and they said, "Now, Mr. Burton, you're going to tell us the truth, aren't you? You sent those tweets, didn't you? Admit it." So they do speak like that, you know. They're the wonderful people, the British police. But anyway,
they're not embarrassed. I had
absolutely no trouble admitting that. I said, yeah, I sent uh-huh. those tweets. I said I felt I was justified because I was incensed. I was outraged that somebody like Fiaz Magal, in the position that he's got as head of Tell Mama UK, a national organisation receiving hundreds of thousands of pounds every year from the British taxpayer, that somebody like that, who I might add has set up his organisation on a false premise, the false mm-hmm. premise being that Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace, and therefore anybody who opposes Islam must by default be a bigoted, racist, hateful, intolerant Islamophobe. Now, okay. I call that false premise, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he's set his organization up on a false premise, looking for all these masses of examples of online hate crime, only there isn't enough of it to go round, so he has to resort to manipulating the figures to fool the people who are giving him the money into giving him mm-hmm. more money. Now, that is fraudulent. I don't care what anybody says, that's out-and-out fraud, and
right.
he needs to go to jail, that guy, and have his OBE taken off him, and just generally given a boot in the arse, thrown into prison, and have the door shut behind him for a few years.
Right.
And
I'm
think
surprised
that would,
they
be,
didn't,
would be justice.
Yeah. it's hard to believe what goes on over there. I mean, I really feel bad for my cousins across the pond. Because you just don't have a shot the way it is. I mean, you really need a Tony Abbott or that kind of person or a Paul Weston to take control.
Yeah, if we had somebody like Paul Weston in there, we'd have to pretty much go through all the institutions we have over here and clean them out right from the top. Now, exactly how we might do that, it's going to be difficult because it's going to mean a great upheaval. But I don't think it's like the phrase, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. And we are going to have to break a few eggs if we are going to overcome what has been 40 years of corruption in our institutions. And I'm talking about not just the political strata, but also in education. Education is perhaps a key one, because at the moment the educational system is corrupting every child that goes through the educational system from the age of 5 years old up until the age of, 21 or 22, if they go to university. That is a left-wing bias in the educational system. Well, one might almost say a Marxist bias in the educational system that has been getting worse and worse over the last 30 or 40 years. So that has to be completely dismantled.
Maybe you can explain to me, though, why is Paul running for Minister of European Parliament, which means he'll have to go to Brussels if he wins? How does that help England, and how does that help his profile, you know, getting better known and everything?
Well, I certainly think that if you're talking about getting well known, I don't think it hurts to get well known at a European level as well as at a British level. I'm pretty sure that if he gets elected to the European elections, then his name is going to be extremely well known in the UK. Whereas if he got elected as a UK Member of Parliament, he wouldn't be necessarily so well known throughout Europe. And ultimately, I would hope that he would use his persuasive powers, which are legendary, as we know, in order to get us out of Europe, ultimately. Because Europe has... the way that the European Union is constructed, as I'm sure you know and as I'm sure our listeners know, is they are not accountable to anybody for anything, which means they can take our money, spend it as they will, and corrupt our laws and our institutions in all sorts of nefarious ways. And while we're part of the European Union, we can have very little say in it. But if we've got somebody like Paul Weston in place, at least he can go to bat for the interests of our country against what the European Union is trying to impose on us, which is a totalitarian system that will crush us all in the end if it's allowed to.
Just like Obama's doing to us.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Talking of which, I was very interested to hear about what's going to happen on May the 16th. That's something I've only really heard a little about in the...
I don't know that much about it myself. I know it's going to be like a million-person march against Obama, I think. And it's just in the getting started stages. I haven't posted about it yet because I wanted to get more information, also, you know, getting closer to the event. But it sounds good, but it's not going to change anything. We don't have a government that would impeach Obama, and certainly he's committed a lot of impeachable offenses. The House won't take it up. The House has the votes.
Yeah.
But they won't take it up because it'll die in the Senate. The Senate won't even touch it. So, I mean, symbolically, you know, it could be a good thing for Republicans to do it, but it's not going to get anywhere. It's not going to get them out of office. And I think they figure that, you know, thinking back to Bill Clinton, it didn't do them any good to impeach him because, well, he wasn't convicted anyway. They did take it up. But with Obama, they won't even take it up. So they can impeach him, but he's not going to get kicked out of office because the Senate will not try it. That's the way it is. So I understand them not trying to impeach him. But if, you know, if a million people get on the Capitol lawn there and protest Obama, at least it will get attention. I don't know if it'll do any good, though.
Now, it was one of the questions that for the end of last year, I asked several people about it, and I said, it's quite obvious to me that Obama is riding roughshod over the Constitution in so many ways,
mm-hmm.
and if there's a clear case that, as far as I could see it, for impeachment, and I couldn't understand why that wasn't happening. But I had it explained to me that the impeachment process involves having to get the votes from a lot of Democrats in the Senate, and they're not going to do that because the way things are going at the moment, if things don't change, Democrats will be in power forever, and that's obviously what they want. Self-interest comes before the interest of the country as far as Democrats are concerned, and I think that's appalling. Yeah.
Right. Well, we do have a chance to take the Senate back because there's a lot of Senate seats up for election in 2014. And the Obamacare fiasco has hurt Obama a lot. And the Democrats in the Senate know it will hurt them. So they're trying to distance themselves from Obamacare, but that's not going away anytime soon. So it's a possibility we could take the Senate. But, you know, Republicans being what they are, outside of the Tea Party Republicans, they tend to screw things up. They tend to lose elections they should win because, you know, Republicans fight against each other, which is devastating. But I don't hold much hope that we'll take the Senate, but it is a possibility. So.
Well, I certainly hope that something like that happens because what I see is pretty appalling. But I know Kel wants to jump in here at the moment, so I'll hand the mic back to Kel. Kel, could you? The mic's yours.
This is a fascinating segment of the RSB radio show. And Tim and Bonnie, you guys are gelling so well. Bonnie, I was wondering, would you like to stay on a little longer?
Yeah,
you did promise
us
an hour.
Okay, yeah,
well,
I can stay a little longer.
Oh, what I'm going to do then, I'm going to play something and give everybody a chance to refresh their teas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to play this. And Bonnie, we mm-hmm. have a very, very, very fine friend, and his name is Martin Hive, and he puts a lot of the video clips together for the English Defense League, but he also did this for Tim in particular. And I'm going to play it, and we're going to see everybody back here in 4 minutes.
Okay.
In 2013, Mr. Tim Burton, on his Twitter page, Cat Strangler 101, called Fayaz Mughal, the controller of a website that claims to record incidents of hate crime against Britain's Muslim population, a mendacious, grievous-mongering taqiya artist. Mr. Mughal, who has received hundreds of thousands of pounds from the British government, has been proven to have falsified the statistics that his organization, Tell Mama, used. But in the country where Tim Burton lives, telling the factual and provable truth has now become a criminal offense. But receiving hundreds of thousands of pounds from the British government to then misinform, deceive and lie to the British public has not. In Britain today, because of the laws created by politicians from all three of the main political parties, which are then enforced by the British police, the truth now seems to have become illegal. A country where a proven liar, like Faisal Mughal, can telephone the British police and have them arrest Tim Burton and charge him with racially aggravated harassment. Because Fayaz Mughal was simply offended by what Tim Burton had to say about him. Over the years, we have seen our politicians erode the British people's right to free speech with the reintroduction of blasphemy laws, making criticism of anyone's religious beliefs, no matter how offensive those religious beliefs are to the rest of the population, a criminal offense. But as with the case of Tim Burton, we are now living in a country where our right to free speech is, because of our politicians' decisions, being eroded almost to the point of non-existence. We are increasingly not being allowed to express our own opinions on more and more subjects in this country. But in the case of Tim Burton and Faisal Mughal, we are now not even allowed to tell the truth without fear of being arrested by the British police. This is the country we live in today, but it is a country that I do not want to live in. A country created by today's politicians, where a liar can have you arrested for telling the truth because the truth offends him. Britain's politicians, Britain's police, the Tell Mama organization, Fayaz Mughal, the truth is far more important to me than your feelings, your lies, and the laws that you have created to take away my right to free speech. So I will join Tim Burton in saying, mendacious grievance-mongering taqiya artist, and to hell with anyone's feelings. No matter what your political beliefs are, no matter what your religious beliefs are, and no matter what color your skin happens to be, I will not live in a country where having an opinion or telling the truth has become a criminal offense. And we must all help Tim Burton in this fight for freedom, free speech, and the truth.
I'm passing the mic back to you because you and Bonnie have a lot to say, and I just love the conversation that you two are carrying on. So take it away, Tim.
thank you very much, Kel. Yeah, I was most impressed with that video. Martin Hive emailed me a few days ago and said, I think you need a video for what's happening. And I hadn't really thought about it, but Martin Hive has produced some excellent videos in the past. And I said,
I've posted a lot of them. He's done great work for the EDL.
Yes, indeed. And when I saw it, I thought that is such a powerful video. And I was rather pleased to see that Liberty GB themselves have actually put it on their YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And I know quite a few other people have reposted it as well. So I was just so happy with the result because, you know, it's all factually true. And everything that Martin has put on there, he's expressed it in a very, very powerful way. But there's nothing on there that isn't true at all.
Right.
So it's a tremendous video. Right. It really is.
Can I ask you about the EDL? What is your take on what happened with Tommy and Kevin? And do you think they made a good move?
Oh, right. Well, this was the source, as you probably know, of some controversy back in October,
mm-hmm.
because when it first happened, a lot of people commented and said that they'd previously been very loyal to Tommy and to Kevin, and they felt somewhat betrayed by what had actually happened. But I thought about it for a bit, and I posted an essay on the EDL website about it, and I took a slightly different view because I put myself in Tommy's shoes and I said, if I had spent 4 years of my life building up an organization like the EDL, which he was obviously very, very passionate about,
mm-hmm.
and who wouldn't be? Because, you know, a lot of people hate what is happening to our country, what our political elites are allowing to happen. Mainstream media is complicit in demonizing the EDL and every time the EDL is mentioned, the political elites go out of their way to paint it and smear it as a right-wing extremist organization. Mm-hmm. And in spite of all that, he He led it for 4 years, and he built it into an organization that not only resonated with a lot of people in the UK, but also resonated around the world, everywhere, in every country where substantial numbers of Muslims are making their presence felt, and not in a good way, obviously, because they make terrible neighbors, and they introduce all sorts of problems, and there is absolutely nothing positive I can say at all about Islam in any respect in any Western country that you might happen to name. Not that I'm biased or anything, but, you know, that's just my opinion.
Right.
But the point is that Tommy had spent 4 years building the organization to the point where it was not just a national organization, but it had international resonance. And then
several different countries have defense.
Well, that exactly. That's my point. And to walk away from that, I felt he must have been made an offer that he couldn't refuse. Now, when I say that, what I mean is that I think that if he hadn't made the move that he did, he would have ended up, or he or his family would have ended up in possibly a lot of pain, because say what you like about the British government, I think they're capable of anything, and I think they could have made his life so difficult for him and his family that he just felt he had no option but to move away from the leadership of the EDL and partner with this Quilliam Foundation. Now,
I totally understand him wanting to leave the EDL for all the problems and threats and everything he's had with the government. But why go to an organization like Quilliam, which is, you know, allegedly an anti-extremist organization, but I don't think it really is. I think that hurt him. The fact that he left would not have hurt him, but because of where he went and associated himself, to me, that was devastating. I said, I will still support the EDL, but I'm not going to support what Tommy does now.
Well, what I would say to that is, yes, there's two things there. One is he walked away from the EDL, and he said there were various things about the way the EDL was going that he didn't like. Well, if I'd spent 4 years building up the organization, I would try and fix those things. I wouldn't walk away from them. And that's what I mean about, I think he must have been put under tremendous pressure in a way that has not been made public. So walking away from the EDL was one thing. The other thing is that when you talk about the Quilliam Foundation, as far as I'm concerned, they're a bunch of snakes. It's run by Muslims. If it was run by ex-Muslims, I'd have a different opinion of it altogether. But it's not.
Right.
It's run by Muslims, full of taqiyya, as we know. You can't trust a word that they say, and they say they are anti-extremism. But they are not anti-extremism in as much as, you know, looking at extremism even-handedly. The extremism they're concerned about with is the so-called extremism of the EDL. They're not so concerned about Muslim extremism at all. And why should they be? Because at the end of the day, it's Muslim extremism that is advancing the cause of Islam. And that is what any devout Muslim should do at any point in time, is to try and advance the cause of Islam via whatever means possible. So the Quilliam Foundation is full of Muslims who are doing exactly what Muslims should do, advancing the cause of Islam and making the infidel look bad. And so for him to partner with Quilliam, again, I feel he must have been made an offer that he couldn't refuse. I think somebody
must
have said...
Yeah, but now he's in jail anyway. So where did he get him?
Yeah, and I have my own theory about this, which is that once he had been persuaded to walk away from the EDL and been persuaded to publicly associate himself with Quilliam, that the British government or whoever was behind that move in the first place then washed their hands of him and just said, well, we know we promised you this, but you know what? We're going to go back on our word. And you're going to be subject to the full force of the law anyway, because that's the kind of people they are. I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them, the British government.
Right.
And as far as Quilliam are concerned, as I say, I think they're a bunch of snakes. And I certainly wouldn't trust them at all. So,
well,
but
that's
my,
that
is my own personal view.
Sorry. The leader of Quilliam was a member of Hizb ut-Tahrir, that extremist group itself?
Yes, he was. And to what extent, you might be justified in asking, has he renounced the views of that organisation? I suggest that is just another example of a taqiyya, in so far as Muslims are permitted to renounce certain aspects of Islam if it serves the greater goal of advancing Islam, and
right.
which it certainly does. And you could look at Muslims in pretty much any influential organization, and they might, on the face of it, they might present a very smiling face when it comes to talking to infidels about how they believe in Islam as one of the great three Abrahamic religions and all this interfaith outreach stuff that they encourage and so on. But at the end of it, in their hearts, they are still Muslims, and they have to promote the advancement of Islam come what may if they are devout Muslims. And that's why you just can't trust a word that any of them say.
Right.
And,
did you notice how the interfaith outreach only seems to take place in churches and synagogues? You never see it happening in a mosque.
Well, very true. Yeah, the day comes that we've got genuine interfaith outreach and genuine constructive dialogue between Islam and everybody else, well, I'll eat my hat, as we like to say over here. Because, yes, you're absolutely right. The interfaith outreach, which is the various programs that are established by churches and synagogues, I liken it to building a bridge. Now, as any architectural engineer will tell you, before you build a bridge, before you even think about building a bridge, you investigate what the soil is like on both sides of the bridge that you're proposing to build. And if you don't know what is on the other side of the river that you're building the bridge over, you shouldn't be too surprised when it all ends in tears. And that's precisely the position that we're in with interfaith outreach. We've got all these well-meaning bishops and clergy from the church, and all these well-meaning rabbis and so on from the Jewish faith, and they're trying to build bridges and show how tolerant they are in reaching out to the Muslim faith, but they don't realize that there is no sense of compromise or negotiation or give and take from the Muslim side at all, and there never will be.
Right.
Interfaith outreach only goes one way as far as Muslims and Islam are concerned, and that is to allow Islam to subdue and conquer any faith or belief system which is not Islam. And that has always been the case over the last 1400 years, and it will continue to be the case until such time as we can contain and control Islam to the point where it's no longer a threat to the Western world. But
look what the Central African Republic is doing.
Yeah, I see they're
I mean, I'm not suggesting that for England, but you know what? They're fighting back. They have a Muslim minority who staged a coup and overtook the presidency, and they got them out. They got them out. They got a different president, and now they're killing the Muslims, and the Muslims are fleeing. I mean, you know, the methods may be crude, but you know what? They're achieving their goals. They're getting, the dangerous Muslims out of their country.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's an excellent example, Bonnie, because I think part of the problem is that we here in the West, let me be more specific. We here in the UK we've had the good times for so long that we have forgotten that there is such a thing as good and evil. And that every now and again, we have to stand up and fight on the side of good against the evil that, if it were left unrestrained and unchecked, would totally crush our civilization. And it's as bad as that. And we have yet to fully wake up. But when we do, I'm hoping that we'll be able to do it without quite so much blood on the streets as they've had in the Central African Republic. But the thing is that Muslims, once they sense that they're getting on a path to a position of power, they're not going to give up quietly. And so it might become a little bit more difficult than we would like. But nevertheless, it shows, when you see things like that are happening in the Central African Republic, it just shows that we can we can turn this around if the will is there. And of course, it's not just Central African Republic. We're starting to see Buddhists fighting back in Burma, well, Myanmar.
Well, you know what? People, you know, you wouldn't know it from the coverage the media gives it. I think I'm like a one-person PR agency for Myanmar, because every post I make, it shows why the Buddhists are doing what they do and what the Muslims have done that have caused the peaceful Buddhists to become violent. And our media, European media, nobody is covering it that way. It's, oh, the poor Muslims, the genocide, blah, blah, blah. And nobody gives the other side. I have correspondents in Burma that send me articles that the media here won't publish. And it's a shame, because the Buddhists are getting blamed for genocide when they're trying to save their country from a Muslim takeover, as the Muslims have done in so many other Buddhist countries.
But, oh, yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, what I would say about that is, what that shows is that Muslims are very good at playing the victim, and they have elevated deception and lying into an art form, so that the picture that they present to the outside world, as you say, is of the victim, the poor put upon Rohingya Muslims in Burma, who are being attacked by these nasty Buddhists for no reason at all. And of course, whenever you get a conflict like this, it's always because the Islamic supremacist ideology that drives everything that Muslims do has come to the forefront. They've seen their chance. They've gone into lands that don't belong to them. They've tried to take them over. And it's not just Burma, of course. It's everywhere around the world where Muslims gain the appropriate percentage of the population that emboldens them and makes them feel that they're in with a chance, that they will do it anywhere. And when the population tries to fight back, as indeed they're doing in the Central African Republic and in Myanmar and, well, everywhere else where people fight back, then they immediately run whining to anybody who will listen and complaining how they're being targeted and they're the victims of, as you say, of genocide against Muslims, when, of course, nothing's further than the truth.
The UN is talking out against them. There's a resolution right now in the U.S. Congress to condemn the Buddhists for their genocide of Muslims, which that makes me crazy. I mean, I've posted on and have all my readers writing to their representatives and sending them, you know, the stuff I've posted, which shows videos of the slaughter that Muslims are doing to the Buddhists there, killing monks, raping children. I mean, it's horrible. Oh, and that never gets out. It just drives me crazy that our Congress would waste time on, you know, a condemnation of that without knowing the facts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is what I mean about the mainstream media being complicit in the advancement of Islamization throughout the West. Every story is biased in favor of Muslims against everybody else. And it's an absolutely crazy scenario. As you say, Muslims paint themselves as the victims. The mainstream media is only too happy to push this narrative. And it's a complete inversion of the truth. The fact is that Muslims in pretty much every case are the ones that have instigated the problem in the first place by not only refusing to integrate and assimilate, but then imposing their Islamic supremacist beliefs on the rest of the population by force if necessary. And of course,
demanding an area be made an Islamic state within, they're doing that in Thailand, Philippines, everywhere they are, they want to take a little piece and make it Islamic, and then they go for the whole.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the point. If you look back in the history of Islamic expansion over 1400 years, I mean, all you have to do is Google the phrase Tears of Jihad, and you'll see exactly the same pattern repeating over and over again over the last 1400-year period. Anywhere in the world that Muslims have expanded and increased their population, the pattern is identical. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it everywhere, and we're certainly seeing it in Europe now. And Muslims are pushing at the moment in the UK. They're pushing for little enclaves in the various cities to become 100% Muslim. And it's not difficult for them to do that, because once they achieve a certain percentage of the population in any area, they make life so unpleasant for their neighbours that their neighbours don't want to live next to Muslims. I mean, who wants to live next to Muslims when they behave in that appalling manner, which they always do, invariably do, when they get sufficient numbers? And it doesn't have to be out and out blood on the streets. It can be in little intimidating things, you know, a brick through your window, slash your car tires, you know, poison your dog or something like that. Pretty soon, you don't want to live there, so you leave. Right. And then
we used to call that blockbusting in the U.S.
Oh, right.
They would put in a black family and then, you know, buy up more houses. What happens with the Muslims, you know, they force white flight, as they say. People move out, and then the home values for the rest of the people diminish. And, you know, within 10 years, you have a whole Muslim neighborhood and no go zone, right?
That's exactly how it happens. And we're starting to see that certainly in the UK and in a lot of places in Europe. And at some point, we are going to have to do something to reverse it if we're not going to end up with either balkanization of the various countries or civil war. It is reversible without question. Right now, as we speak, the process is reversible. In 25 years' time, it may not be, or it may not be without an enormous fight. And I'm reminded of Winston Churchill's words here, which, I might have to paraphrase slightly, but if you don't try to reclaim or try to win the fight when the odds are on your side, you may find that in the future you're going to have to fight when the odds are very much against you and where you've got almost no hope of winning. Okay, I'm paraphrasing, and I'm sure somebody will know the exact quotation I mean, but nevertheless, he was a very perspicacious man, and what he's basically telling us, or we can draw from his words, is the fact that we have an opportunity to do something about it now. We are, you and I are, and Kel and everybody else who's on Blog Talk Radio and who's listening to us, we are all doing something about it now, even if it's only explaining to some of the listeners the nature of some of the problems, or if it's our listeners going out and talking to their colleagues about what they've heard on Blog Talk Radio tonight and on the other times we've had these shows, we are doing something about it, and it can make a difference. And if we don't do it now,
Churchill was far ahead of his time when he made some statements about Islam that are definitely true. Today he'd probably be arrested for saying what he said.
Well, that's certainly true. Yeah, he was certainly accurate. Again, I'm paraphrasing because I haven't got it in front of me, but over 100 years ago, he wrote in a book called The River War. I think it was around about 1899. And he was describing Islam then in the countries that he'd visited in Africa. I think it was in the Sudan and surrounding countries. And he was saying that everywhere that Islam flourishes, the society becomes degraded. Everything that he wrote, you could look at pretty much every Muslim society today and agree with that 100 years on. And that's because that Islam has a very poor civilizational model. Now, Muslims might say to you, well, Islam is a wonderful, peaceful religion, you know, the most perfect thing and so on. Well, all right, as a belief system, if you want to believe the moon is made of cheese or whatever, you go right ahead. As Thomas Jefferson said, I care not whether a man pray to one God or 20, as long as it does not pick my pocket or break my leg. Okay, if you want to go ahead and pray in your own private way, that's fine. Nobody's bothered. But of course, Islam being a political ideology first and foremost, it affects everybody else around them. And What we've seen is as true now as it was 100 years ago, as it was 1400 years ago. Muslims follow the doctrines of Islam. It's a very poor civilizational model. It can't hold a candle to the Judeo-Christian civilizational model, which has been responsible for all the advances we've seen, certainly, let's go back over the last few hundred years. And I would argue that to date, the Judeo-Christian civilizational model remains vastly superior to the Islamic one, and everywhere the Islamic civilizational model is implemented, Muslims are at the bottom of every measurable scale, whether it's infant mortality, longevity, education, achievements in art and literature, scientific technology, pretty much everything measurable, Muslims are right at the bottom of the heap, and they're at the bottom of the heap because of Islam. And
right.
That's it. End of story.
Well, it'd be good if countries would declare that Islam is not a religion and make it illegal to practice it there. That's what Angola did. Now, there's controversy whether they banned it or not. They didn't issue an outright ban, but they made it illegal, you know, to have mosques and to practice Islam. And, you know, they've been condemned for it, but that's a little country. And they were able to do something like that. Why can't the rest of us?
Well, yeah, quite. Why
you know, we have freedom of religion, but if you declare Islam not to be a religion and a political system that it is, then there's no more freedom of religion for Muslims.
Well, quite.
We don't consider it a religion.
Well, quite so. I mean, everybody on this show, I'm sure, agrees with you 100% on that, and I know I certainly do. But it raises an interesting point, because one of the things about going back to my particular case, what I have been charged with is racially aggravated harassment. Okay, this is
even
this
though
is the
Islam
charge.
Is not a race.
Well, this is the thing, you see.
That you should bring that up too. I'm sick of hearing that I'm a racist because of what I say about Islam. And I must have asked 1,000 people on my blog what race is Islam, and I've yet to get an answer.
Well, don't you worry, Bonnie. That will certainly raise its head in court on the day. But the point is that Muslims themselves would very much like for Islam to receive the privileges that come with being a race. And so they are looking at the moment to see if there's any way that Islam could be accepted as a race in law, believe it or not. Now, at the moment, it isn't. And certainly in the UK, it's specifically, if you look at these Crown Prosecution Service guidelines and so on, it specifically says that racial groups can include things like Jews and Sikhs, but it specifically does not include Muslims. And Muslims don't like that very much, because it means that they don't have the protections under the law that Jews and Sikhs do. But I would say to Muslims, be careful what you wish for, because if you want Islam to be reclassified from a religion to a race, or maybe incorporate aspects of race into the law, then the door is open for Islam to be reclassified. And if we're going to reclassify it at all, we should be reclassifying it, as you say, as a political ideology, a totalitarian political ideology that has far more in common with Nazism and communism than it does with Judaism and Christianity, I might add.
Right.
So they should be careful what they wish for.
Mm, I know. I have another question about your media, because I've seen with our media, I often wonder, are the mainstream media being paid off by these, you know, rich Gulf states or Muslims? I mean, Fox News, which used to be very hard on Islam, has suddenly softened its coverage, and there's a lot less coverage of Islamic issues since the Saudis bought, I think they now have 18% of News Corp, which is Fox News. And the coverage is still better than the rest of the stations, but it's not like it was. Do you suspect any money changing hands in your media?
Oh, I wouldn't be at all surprised, Kel. Bonnie, I should say. I wouldn't be at all surprised, because there is obviously a lot of money that's available for the corruption and subversion of organisations and institutions in the West, without a doubt. You've only got to look at, political, not so much political parties overtly, but if you look at the educational system, for example, over here we're getting a lot of Muslim organizations that are volunteering to donate money to universities and colleges. And of course, a lot of universities or colleges that might be cash strapped and could do with the money to, well, do all sorts of things, could be very tempted to take that money and then soften their stance on Islam or introduce Islam-friendly courses. And, of course, that I would not be at all surprised to know that the same sort of thing was happening in the media, because wherever Islam goes, Muslims want to influence the media. And what better way to do it? Sorry? Well, quite. I mean, what better way to promote mm-hmm. Islam by influencing the media and getting the media to do your work for you? So I am quite sure that that does go on. I wouldn't like to say to what extent, because I'm just not that familiar. But you have to ask yourself, what is most likely? And what is most likely, as far as I'm concerned, from what I can see, from the evidence that I can see, is that our institutions, educational institutions and media institutions, are certainly being corrupted by money which has an Islamic source, and that money is being pumped into these organizations in exchange for them showing Islam in a good light. And I'm sure that's happening. I'm sure it is.
Yeah, well, you see it in all the stories where there's a crime committed and they don't give, you know, any details about the person, you know, the name, nationality, ethnic origin, nothing. I mean, if it's a white person hitting on or, you know, committing a crime against a person of color, you hear about it, right, you know, immediately. And sometimes, I mean, I have to, you know, when I see a story that smells like it's a Muslim crime, I have to do so much research going to, like, the city it happened in, where you'll get the truth from a local newspaper more than the mainstream newspaper. It's amazing. And usually I'm right, and it ends up it's a Mohammed who did it or whatever, but they never say so. I mean, they have to eventually print the name, and that's usually a dead giveaway.
Yeah, it's a bit of a giveaway. Yeah.
Right. Unfortunately, Muslims have very popular names, so it's easy to pick them out. But, boy, they never want to connect it to Islam or jihad or anything. I like to call a lot of these crimes sudden jihad syndrome. But never use that.
No, that's right. I mean, we have, there's one particular website over here. I can't bring it to mind, but I'm sure I'll find it. And they have a poll, but a set of results they publish each week with lists of crimes that are carried out by Muslims. And they refer to that list of crimes having a Muhammad coefficient. So if there's like a particular crime and it's got four criminals in it and three of them are called Muhammad, then that's a Muhammad coefficient of 75%, you see.
Wow.
And it's quite an entertaining way of expressing the criminality. And in fact, I actually posted a tweet not so long ago on my Twitter timeline to say that, in my view, being criminal while Muslim should be an aggravating aspect to a criminal offence and not a mitigating aspect, as it is so often at the moment.
You can't possibly do that with somebody like David Cameron as your leader, who said even the slaughter of Lee Rigby had nothing to do with Islam.
Oh yeah, I mean that's another thing I like to say, is that when a politician stands up and says that a particular event is nothing to do with Islam, you can be sure that it's everything to do with Islam. That's a good rule of thumb to follow. But yeah, I mean, David Cameron's a huge disappointment to me, and while we've got him in power, we're not going to be able to implement any common sense reform at all that's going to lead to any improvement in the situation that I can see. And it's a great shame. But he's got obviously bigger fish to fry, and he's not too worried if the indigenous population gets crushed and subdued and ultimately slaughtered by Islam, as long as he gets to stay in power.
When is your next election for Prime Minister?
Well, we have an election, I think, in about 14 months' time. And, 14 months is a long time in politics, and you might be surprised at what happens. But the big problem with our democratic political system, as it is, as I think, in most countries, is that it's geared towards very short-term thinking, which is to say that a politician, if he gets into power, his goal is to stay in power for maybe 5 years, 10 years, or if he's really lucky, 15 years, at which point he can grab his gold-plated pension and jet off into the sunset to spend the rest of his days behind a walled enclave in a sunny part of the Caribbean or something like that, and he doesn't have to worry about the rest of us. If we had politicians who thought long-term about what would be good for the country and the preservation of Judeo-Christian civilization, then things would be much different and much better. But at the moment, we don't have politicians who think in those terms. And I think it's I think it's a great shame.
What do you think of UKIP? I mean, they seem like they're not very tough on Islam, except for one person in that party seems to be. But the rest, I don't know. Are they a viable alternative?
Well, I'll give you my perspective on that, Bonnie, and then what I'd like to do is briefly pass the mic over to Kel, because I know she's got a couple of points concerning that. But my take on UKIP is that they have one main policy, which is to get the UK out of the European Union. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, that's a very good policy.
Right.
And if we could actually get a party into power that would take us out of the European Union at the next elections, mm-hmm. that would be a great thing. But the thing about UKIP is they don't really have much in the way of credible policies apart from that one, which is why I prefer Liberty GB, because they are predominantly, they've got a handle on a lot of the major issues that mm-hmm. Affect our country. Obviously, getting us out of the European Union is one big one. Turning round the tide of Islamic encroachment is another big one, but they've also got policies in a lot of other different areas. And I know Kel has been speaking with one or two of the Liberty GB representatives on that score. So I'll pass the mic briefly over to Kel, and perhaps you can pick up on that, Kel.
I just want to say that we're having issues in Canada, Bonnie, and it's getting worse up here. I've always been rather gloating in that, well, Canada seems to be on top of the Islamism of arriving at our shores, but it doesn't seem to be that way. And pardon me if I sound a little downhearted, but I was just reading in the paper today that there was a student evicted from a Muslim-only class in Canada, and this occurred at the Ontario University of London, and that they teach what's going on. It's the Huron College, and the course is called The Muslim Voice, Islamic Preaching, Public Speaking, and Worship. Essentially what it is, it's how to prophesize. Mm-hmm. And this one student registered, but because he was a non-Muslim, he was evicted from the class. Now, this really, really annoys me, because what's happening is that my...
Is that legal?
I don't even know. Hmm. I don't even know. What I've been doing is that I have been dogging Liz Sandals, and she is the education minister for Ontario, Canada. Mm-hmm. I have been dogging her. I sent her another email again today. She won't return my emails. She won't mm-hmm. return my phone calls. The politicians they're either dignified or they're totally ignorant. And this school in particular, it receives $6.5 million tax dollar monies a year, Bonnie, mm-hmm. and I'm just getting fed up with it.
Yeah, that's horrendous. That's got to be illegal. I mean, your system isn't that different than ours. I mean, what excuse do they give? Just because he was a non-Muslim? That can't possibly stand.
They thought he was some sort of auditor. They thought he was an auditor, and uh-huh. that he was enrolling just to audit the class.
Uh-huh.
And what was going on essentially is that the school administrator, his name is Stephen McClatchy. He's the principal of the college, and he said that he regretted the student whose name is, here, let me scroll myself up here because I'm going on notes here. But Moray Watson, he enrolled in the course, and they felt that he was an auditor of the program. And so Stephen McClatchy, he said that, well, we don't want auditors in this particular class. And another person, the professor, her name is Dr. Ingrid Mattison. I call her the baghead. And she also verified that she would not allow this. But I just wanted to say that. I wanted to share that with you, Bonnie. I'll send you the link later on.
Why don't you send me the link, because I hadn't heard that yet.
Oh, I will. It just came out today. I will, Bonnie. But I'm going to pass it back to Tim, and perhaps you two can pick it up. I'm really enjoying this conversation between the two of you.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Kel. Yeah, that particular article in Canada, Kel was talking to me about it just before we came on air today, and it does sound like an appalling thing that a school can set up with taxpayers' money and then discriminate against non-Muslims in that way. I mean, I can see why they would not want a non-Muslim on that course, because, of course, if they're teaching Muslims about how to proselytize and advance Islam, then sooner or later the tricky question will come up of what attitude should we take to all these pesky Christians and Jews? Ah, well, in that case, I think we should subdue them or slaughter them. And of course, when they get to that point, if there's any non-Muslims listening, they'll probably be quite appalled. And if they're doing kind of auditing, then I'm sure questions would be asked about continued funding. So of course they don't want non-Muslims on a course like that. But the way they're phrasing it is they're saying, oh, well, it's not so much that we don't want non-Muslims. It's just that there's only a limited number of spaces, and it just so happens we won't be able to fit him on there.
They're calling him an auditor, and he isn't. He enrolled as a regular student, and they have no right to do that, and he should sue them.
Well, that may well come about. I'm not sufficiently familiar with Canadian law to say how feasible that is. I mean, it certainly seems like a reasonable course of action to me, Bonnie. I'll say that. But yes, I mean, we have to keep fighting back against this sort of thing all the time, because they are relentless in pushing forward the agenda of Islam in every little possible way that they can.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, that's what they have to do as devout Muslims. That's their job description as devout Muslims, is to advance Islam in every way possible, big or small. And whether it's pushing Islamic courses of this nature and keeping out the unwanted attentions of non-Muslims while they're doing it, that's one way. You'll get the Muslim that will complain about, I don't know, let's think of something small. I mean, the Muslim that complains about not having enough religious accommodation at work and ends up suing their employer. We've had a lot of those.
I have a whole series of 100 Muslim reasons.
I don't doubt it. And I think it would pay to repost that in pretty much every medium.
Well, I do. Whenever I find a new one, I post a link to more reasons why you should never hire a Muslim.
Yes, absolutely.
No, it's true. Employers get screwed left and right with these demands. You know, first you know, the hijab, then the prayer room, then time off for prayer, and special accommodations for Ramadan. It never ends. Once you get into them once, it never ends. That's why you've got to do everything you can not to hire one in the first place.
Well, absolutely. I agree entirely with that. And the trouble is that, I mean, this comes back to what I was talking about right at the start of the show with taqiyya and other forms of deception. We in the West are not used to dealing with an entire class of people who have elevated lies and deceit to an art form, which is what is the case with Muslims. And this is why, if you're going to have any kind of interaction with Muslims at all, the trust issue is of paramount importance. You cannot assign to Muslims the same level of trust as you would to non-Muslims. I mean, that's something that we are just not used to doing in our civilization. If you go out the door in the morning, whether it's to go down to the shops to buy a bottle of milk, or if you go to work, or any way in which you interact with your fellow man, there is a certain level of give and take and trust that you have between yourself and your fellow man that we have taken for granted. But that is something you cannot apply if Muslims are in the equation, because sooner or later, if you do, you'll get screwed. And people are finding that out to their cost. And of course, when they bring it up, they're told, oh, it's your fault because you're a racist. You haven't allowed these poor people the opportunity to assimilate and integrate. And we keep doing this. We keep treating Muslims as if they needed these special accommodations because they're somehow...
If they don't want to assimilate, it's fine. We have groups in the United States, the Amish and some other groups like that, even Orthodox, very Orthodox Jews, the Hasidim. They don't want to assimilate, and they have their own communities, their own schools, their own businesses, and they don't bother anybody. You know, of course, they're not killing anybody or threatening to take over the country, but they bought land and they have their families, and they don't bother anybody, which is fine. You can do that in this country. If Muslims had done that, nobody would even notice them. But it's because of their dogma of trying to make the world Islamic that they've moved into, although they have their own communities within communities, but then, you know, they go about trying to change our institutions and our customs and trying to impose their beliefs and make everyone accommodate their religious beliefs. That's the difference. If they were like the Amish, nobody would have a word against them.
Well, yeah, that's a very good analogy. And as you say, if they were like the Amish, we wouldn't have a problem at all. But the Islamic imperative to make the whole world Islamic, which is what drives every single Muslim that you come across, and the fact that they have elevated, as I just said, lying and deceit into an art form, means that we are at a disadvantage, because these people not only want to take us over and subdue us and eventually rule over us or have us all killed, but they will smile in our faces while they are doing it. And the reason they do that is in the Quran. It's perfectly acceptable to smile in the face of your enemy while inwardly your hearts curse them. Now, that is actually a surah, a verse in the Quran. And I normally, when I say these things, I back them up with chapter and verse, and I can't do it at the minute, but nevertheless, I'll see what I can do before time's up. We are at a disadvantage because we're generally trusting people, because that's part of our Judeo-Christian civilization, our traditions and values. We have been trusting. But when you're up against people who do not reciprocate, then it's suicidal to carry on the same practice. And we have to recognize it, and we have to be firm about it. We have to say we cannot allocate the same kind of trust to Muslims if they are not prepared to return that trust, and they stab us in the back at every opportunity, which is what they do. But it'll take time. But you and I, Bonnie, and Kel, and everybody else listening here, we're on the right track. We know what needs to be done, and we just have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing until we obtain a critical mass, and then it will get done, without a doubt.
And we have we're running out of time, but we have Siko, who wants to make a very, very, very quick point. And Siko, welcome to the program. Make it very, very quick. Thank you.
I told you I was going to make it quick, and I promise I will. Okay, with the Muslims pushing for everything to be Muslim this and Muslim that, everything has to accommodate to us. Well, it has to accommodate to Islam and surrender and submission and all this. Where is it for every other religion? Why is no other religion pushing as hard as Muslims are? Why is it that every other religion is like, okay, just let them have whatever you want? Why don't you Christians stand up a little bit and say, hey, we want the same rights as them too?
No, I just have a one-word sentence. Abolish, Siko. We just have to abolish. We have to get our voices out there. We have to get our blogs out there. We have to get our radio programs out there. We have to educate the public, and we have to expose Islam for what it absolutely is, and we have to stop the scourge. And I'll pass it back to Tim.
Okay. The main thing I would answer that question with, Seiko, is we have been far too used to making Islam equivalent in religious terms to Judaism or Christianity, whereas it's not a religion at all. And the reason that Islam does what it does is because it is primarily, first and foremost, political. It's a political ideology with religious overtones rather than a religion with political overtones. And it's the politics that drives everything, which is why you get Islam doing what it does, and you don't see that with other religions, well, with religions such as Judaism and Christianity. And if anybody asks you, I might add, if how you tell the difference between a religion and a political ideology, you just explain that Islam does not follow the golden rule. And the golden rule, which is do as you would be done by, is crucial to every religion that's pretty much existed since the dawn of mankind. And Islam does not follow that. And for that reason alone, I would not classify it as a religion, and I would move to classify it as a political ideology. And if we were to do that, we would find a lot of our problems would disappear. But I'd just briefly pass it over to Bonnie in case you wanted to add anything to that, Bonnie.
Yeah, I think the problem is that uncharacteristically the left accommodates Islam, and they encourage them to do whatever they do, where they would condemn any other religion that did the same thing. I mean, they're very anti-Christian, a lot of them. A lot of Jews are anti-Jewish. But they're, you know, bend over backwards for the Muslims. And, you know, if you want to take it to its farthest analogy, I mean, it's almost a communistic thing. They want to get rid of all religion, but because Islam wants to get rid of all other religions, they are kind of convenient allies. So the left fights us as much as the Muslims do, and that makes it very difficult, considering, you know, maybe half the country is more left-leaning, to do anything, because they have built-in allies. And I know that should they ever get rid of everybody else and conquer the world between the two of them, then they'd be fighting each other. But for now, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that's the left enables them. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Kel, could I... I know we're coming down to the close of the show tonight. I've really enjoyed myself immensely talking with you, Bonnie, and I really hope you come back again soon so we can catch up on talking more.
I learned a lot about England.
Oh, Bonnie, we would love to have you back. Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to RSB Radio with your host, Kel Fritzy and Tim Burton, and our guest tonight was Bonnie of Bare Naked Islam. You can find her site at http://www.barenakedislam.com. Please check out her site. Believe me, this lady knows her stuff, and she is one of many out there, counter-jihadists, educating America, Canada, England, New Zealand, Australia, China, the world. Bonnie, thank you so very much for being here, and I'll be talking
with
you
soon. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. It was an
absolute
pleasure.
Great.
Thank you, Tim.
I second that.
Great talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you, Bonnie, and I hope to speak to you again soon.
Me too. Okay, take care.
Yes, you too, Bonnie.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And ladies and gentlemen, just to remind you, a programming note, our boss, Vito Esposito, is having his program tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That is a little over an hour from now at the Blog Talk Radio, so please try to join us there. And Tim and myself, we are part of the Radio Jihad Network, in which we are the freedom-loving infidels. And you can hear Tim and myself Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So please try to join us there as well. Tim, great show.
Yeah, it was tremendous. It was tremendous. I really love having Bonnie on. She's absolutely amazing guest, and she's got a great website. And I forgot to ask her to send me some links about the 101 reasons not to employ a Muslim. But I'm sure if I look on the website, I'll find them. And I think I might repost some.
Oh, you'll find them.
Twitter,
oh, absolutely.
Timeline.
But it was a wonderful show, and we want to thank everybody who joined us. We want to thank Bigfoot, Kath, Dodgy Dave, Jeff from the English Defense League radio show, Eric Kyle, Luchador, Moving Forward, and, of course, Vito Esposito. And, guys, please do stay tuned. We are tuning out, but I will be back here Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the RSB radio network, where I fly solo. But Tim, we're out of here.
Well, that was absolutely tremendous, Cal, and I can't wait for the next show, which I'm going to try and stay up and catch a little later on tonight. I'm going to look forward to that. And I know Vito was after the Martin Hive clip, and did I see
Yeah.
Oh, that's
I sent it to him already.
All right. That's great. Well, in that case, I'd just like to say thank you very much to all our listeners for staying with us tonight and listening to Kel and myself with Bonnie from Bare Naked Islam. And hopefully we'll catch you all next week on Red Fox
and
Blogger.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful evening. Tim and myself, as usual, will catch you right here on RSB Network at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we will catch you at the Freedom Loving Infidels on
I forgot to mention Freedom Loving Infidels, yes, and that's tomorrow night at 11 p.m. GMT, which is 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, if I'm not mistaken, Kel, tomorrow
that's
night.
Right. Heard right here, right there, right everywhere on the Radio Jihad Network. Tim, have a wonderful evening. I'll talk to you soon.
Yes, talk to you soon then, Kel. See you soon.
Okay.
Bye now.
Good night, everybody.
Keep hope alive.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb.
Keep hope alive.
Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. Give you the will to carry on another day. Day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter, it's a little girl and a little boy. Want your foolish pride, want your beautiful joy, even what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood, they create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats give you the strength of a thousand men. Gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna be alright. Some harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds, clearing the showers. Well, here's to you, two shots of whiskey, one Jameson, one Johnny Powers. From Coney Island to Seaside Heights, Long Beach, Freeport, the Lower East Side, Massapequa to Sheepshead Bay, a city island to the Rockaway.